Welcome to the Future of Love teleseries presented by the Integral Spiritual Experience, Integral Life, and iEvolve Global Practice Community. The Future of Love dialogues continue this week with Deepak Chopra. Deepak is a New York Times best-selling author, founder of the Chopra Foundation, and the founder and co-chairman of Chopra Center for Well-Being in Carlsbad, California. He is joined in this dialogue by world spirituality teacher and core founder of iEvolve, Dr. Mark Gaffney. In their dialogue, Deepak and Mark will talk about the core principles of love as they emerge from the great Hindu teachings and find resonance in modern science. It is with much pleasure we present Deepak Chopra with Dr. Mark Gaffney.
Yeah, Deepak, it's great to have you here. Welcome, welcome. Where are you talking to us from?
I'm in Toronto, Canada.
Ah, so that makes you international?
In a sense, yes. Although there are no boundaries anymore.
There are no boundaries anymore. Well, from that place of no boundary consciousness, it's a delight to welcome you to the Integral Spiritual Experience Future of Love teleseries. And it feels like there's a real evolutionary integral field emerging. We just started a few weeks ago. Ken and I started the dialogue series. And then my partner in this series and iEvolve, in an Integral Spiritual Experience, Diane Mushel Hamilton, was with Marilyn Schlitz, and then with Roger Walsh and Francis Vahan, and then last week with Andrew Cohen. I think you're spending part of your day with Andrew and Marilyn and Ken or something like that.
Later.
So I think we're all kind of part of the same field of emergence, and perhaps that's the best place to begin, to welcome everyone. You can make comments on the Facebook page and leave, you know, the discussion insights that you have after the dialogue, and follow us on Facebook. We have about 12,000 people, you know, and counting, who have signed up, right, for the series. Many, 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 many people are on the phone. Many people are on the webcast, and it's delightful to be with you. And the frame, that's fantastic, yeah. The frame I want to set up, and I'm going to turn it to you, Deepak. I'll just set up a frame and then kind of unfold through a kind of journey into love. The frame we want to set up for today is I'll share, you know, some opening question or insight from the world of both my native tradition, which is Kabbalah, and from the integral theory perspective, which is where we're kind of dancing in. And Ken is, of course, with us deeply today, and really was so delighted, Deepak, that you were going to be on the series and asked to send. I know you're going to be speaking to him later in the day in a different context, but just to announce and to say that we are utterly delighted and honored that you're going to be giving the lead keynote address at the Great Evolutionary Integral Gathering, Integral Spiritual Experience at Asilomar, bringing in the new year at the end of 2010. So we just all want to thank you for that.
I'm looking forward to that.
And we are, people are coming from right now, like 33 countries around the world, international, and completely delighted and excited we are to be with you.
Well,
so let's begin. Thank you. Let's dive right in. So in the kind of popular discourse, you know, love is often understood as an emotion, mm-hmm. right? When you kind of think about it that way, then you're kind of waiting for Cupid's arrow to hit you, because the emotion seems to come from the outside. You're blinded by love. You're love struck, right? It happens to you. Cupid's arrow hits you, and oops, there it was. It hit the secretary, right? It's kind of hard to follow Cupid's arrow. In Kabbalah, in the ancient tradition, right, love isn't so much an emotion, it's a perception, right? It's a realization of the nature of what is. And in your book, right, by Deepak Chopra, New York Times bestseller, I'm holding it in front of me. It's got a great picture of you, Deepak. And it's called The Path to Love, Spiritual Strategies for Healing, which I have to recommend to everyone. I read the book, must have been right after it came out, and it's a fantastic book. And that realization of the Kabbalah, although drawing from your own very rich and deep, you know, tradition, seems very present in that book. So I thought that might be a good place to start, right? Emerging out of your deep tradition, what is love?
Okay, let's start from the beginning then. Love is unity consciousness. It is enlightenment. It is returning to the ground state of being. It is the essence of spirit. It is that which permeates the whole universe and is part of the fabric of space-time geometry. It is what differentiates, ultimately. into space-time, energy, information, and the world of objects. So it is the essence of existence. Now, you mentioned love as an emotion and perception. All that is true, partly, because those are flavors of love. Anything that brings us back to our source is a flavor of love. So romantic love, love between parents and children, love between siblings, love for the world, love for art, love for humanity, love for Mother Earth, love for the ecosystem, love for sentient beings, compassion, kindness, joy at the success of others, equanimity. These are divine attributes that bring us back to our source. So in a sense, they are flavors of love, but they're not love in its purity. They're expressions of love. So the way I see it is that love differentiates into diversity as so many souls, so many ways of looking at the world, and so many objects of observation. So love is before the subject-object split, mm-hmm. that is creation. And then the journey begins when we start to feel a twinge of love or an emotion. Then we want, if you're aware, we say, what is this and where is it leading to me to? And then there's a whole path that love unfolds. So it's I would say love is yoga also, because it brings you back to union. And there are many ways to go there, but love is the most enjoyable.
Well, that is an enjoyable and delightful way to begin, and perhaps the best way to recapitulate and reflect back to everyone what Deepak is sharing with us is that all of the sentences that Deepak said love is, you know, and then ended it with some description, which we're really saying is love is the end of the sentence.
That's it.
Right. Love yes. is and. Yeah, and
love is.
And
even when we do terrible things, it's a call for love. So there is nothing that is not outside of love, because there's nothing that is outside of God's consciousness, which is love. Now, when we forget that, we lose the memory of that experience or the source, then, of course, we find sometimes even pathological ways of getting back. And so our distress and what comes out of that distress is a cry for love. Heinous act like terrorism is a cry for love.
So I want to come back and go deeply into that, because, of course, you've opened up a huge field, but I want to go slowly here because you're saying so much. I want to make sure that I can kind of catch it and reflect it back, because, you know, part of love is to know what your job is, and my job in this next hour is to actually catch and reflect back. So I want to be very much in that role. So let me just catch something here. So in evolutionary integral terms, the way we might want to say it, and tell me if you think that's an accurate translation into that discourse, that love is actually the animating evolutionary impulse, right, of the cosmos, right? Yes. It is the motive force of evolution.
It is. It is the motive force of evolution. Now, of course, in the cosmos, in order to have creation, there is the motive evolutionary force, which you call love, but there is also its opposite, which is separation of fear and everything that stems from that, including guilt, shame, anger, resentment, grievances, judgment, self-righteous morality. All of that is the force that is, for lack of a better word, the force of inertia. So you have the evolutionary motive impulse, and then you have the force of inertia, and then you have the tension between the two, which creates the experience of contrast, and without that contrast, there would be no experience. If you had only the evolutionary force, then the universe would rapidly burn itself into the heat death of absolute zero, and if you had only inertia, then you would collapse into a black hole before you could say Deepak Chopra or Jack Robinson. So this combination, this dance between evolution and entropy is what creates the universe. Obviously, evolution is always ahead, otherwise there would not be evolution.
as we would say, thank God, literally.
Yeah. So it is always ahead. And I think the more one favors truth, goodness, harmony, beauty, love, compassion, joy in our own consciousness, the more one accelerates that evolutionary impulse in the direction of enlightenment.
So that's the, and that's when we're going to circle back to that as we unfold, right? What a person, what Deepak's already addressing is what a person can actually do personally, right, to participate, right, in that evolutionary force and to strengthen it in some direct way. So we're going to come back and I'm going to ask you much more about that in, I hope, about a half hour from now. But first, just to kind of hold a kind of trajectory so we can kind of unfold together. So what we've heard from Deepak is love is, right? Love is the evolutionary impulse. It's dancing with entropy. And in that dance, in the space, right, the chasm between them, as it were, the world emerges. So now let's, from the place of love is, let me turn and ask you questions about love's flavors, right, as you call them so beautifully. So when we talk about love's flavors, and I know that you're coming from an incredible integration of traditions. You know, you're probably a Vaishnavite, a Shaivite, and a Shakta. Right, and a doctor, right, and a person extremely versed, right, in you know the cutting edges of physics and neuroscience, and it's the particular, you know, unique self of Deepak Chopra, at least the one that we see publicly, right, the gorgeous inside one, you know, we don't know enough about, but you know when we see the autobiography, we'll learn about that, but we see the unique self of Deepak Chopra is the gorgeous way you integrate them, right, and they kind of become a seamless one in virtually all of your writings. So from that place, to really invite all of that, right, to kind of be present with us, right, when we talk about the flavors of love, there's a great discussion today, Deepak, about unconditional and conditional love, right? So there's kind of the old view of conditional love, you know, show up, you know, do something for me, you know, achieve, right, and you're lovable. Then there's a kind of, you know, great discourse on unconditional love, which on one hand is kind of beautiful and wonderful, and on the other hand, kind of, you know, you kind of wonder, right, well, you know, does it kind of lack responsibility? Does it lack integrity? And in your book, The Path to Love, you actually dance between these two. I mean, you talk about, you know, under everything, innocence is still intact. You know, it's a beautiful sentence. Right? And that to actually know that you're actually participating in every moment, no matter what, as a hero in an internal love story. Right? And yet you speak, you know, very clearly to responsibility. So maybe if you could speak to this flavor of love, these two flavors, the dance between conditional love and needing to be responsible and utterly unconditional love.
Okay. First of all, I do apologize for the fact that the book was written such a long time ago, and I was proud of the book, and I still am, but I am not totally now familiar with all the detailed content of
the
book. But, you know,
you're completely
back.
Free of that. You've written 10 since then, so you're free of that obligation.
Yeah, okay. So here is how I see it. See, every experience that we have and everything that we do is a result of the state of consciousness we are in. So, you know, even as we experience love, it comes from a particular state of consciousness.
That's right.
I think it would be fair to say that everyone is always doing their best from the state of consciousness they're in. Now, I come from a tradition where there's a path. That's why the book was called The Path to Love. And that path has been trodden by people before, and some of them were great seers and sages, and they understood the mechanics of unfoldment of consciousness or the evolution of consciousness. So, and they were map makers, much in the way that Ken Wilber is a map maker. And so they created a map, and I can talk from that map. You know, conditional love, for example, is a very early stage of our experience of love. It comes in a state where our awareness is very limited, and our identity is our little skin-encapsulated ego, to use the expression of Alan Watts.
Right.
So, you know, when we are in that stage, our experience of love is purely conditional. On the other hand, if we were in the enlightened state of unity consciousness, then the love would be purely unconditioned. And then there's the whole range of experience of love from that state, which is purely conditioned, addictive, and predictable, to the other extreme, which is purely unconditioned. So love would be infinite possibilities. Love would be the wisdom of uncertainty. Love would be infinite creativity, infinite harmony, infinite correlation, and would also be part of the intention field, where that love would actually orchestrate the fulfillment of any possible wish or desire, because it would be coming from a place of choiceless awareness and subtle intention and pure love. But, you know, in between, there's this huge range of experience, which makes love a very interesting and journey, and the path also very scenic. So let's talk about the flavors of love as in that path. And okay. I do define them in the book. The first stage is attraction, and I can talk about that when you ask me to. The second stage is second awareness, which in romantic love is very frequently, and romantic love is a good model, by the way, because everybody now and then experiences it. So first stage is attraction. The second stage is second attention, which most people experience as infatuation. The third stage is communion. The fourth stage is intimacy. The fifth stage is surrender and non-attachment. The sixth stage is passion. And the sixth stage is ecstasy, which is the same thing as enlightenment and returning to the primordial state of being that created the whole universe. So those are the sequential unfoldment of flavors, if you will. And in that, we have the whole range of human experience as it relates to love. And when you want me to, I can go into the specifics of each of those stages. So there are earlier stages, then there are middle stages, and then there are these stages that unfold as we get nearer the divine.
Well, that's completely wonderful frame, and I was kind of hoping, you know, I had a little moment there where I was going to, I wanted to talk to you about this frame, but then when you mentioned, well, I don't quite remember that book, I said to myself, okay, let's talk about something else. But
no, I don't remember all the details
but
obviously it's in my consciousness, because it's a part of my experience of reality, so...
I'd be delighted to use that as a frame, and again, I'm going to be, my job here is to go slowly, because, you know, each sentence is so, you know, we could just spend the next 2 hours talking just about, you know, choiceless awareness that Krishnamurti talked so much about, or about almost any sentence you said, we could double click on and spend the next day. So my job is, I'm going to try and kind of unfold. So first, the first thing everyone heard from Deepak, and I want to not lose that sentence, because from an integral perspective, it's an essential sentence that when we say love is, right, that's true, love is. That's an ontologically prior absolute, love is. It's the evolutionary impulse animating the unfolding of the cosmos. And, right, love is always, right, because emptiness is form and form is emptiness, and they're never split from each other, as Nagarjuna taught us. So love is always refracted through the prism of your state of consciousness. And Deepak, that's what you said in the beginning of your paragraph, which from an integral perspective is really important, because, of course, a person can say, I'm a great lover, and they're on an ethnocentric stage of consciousness, and they're a fantastic shaman. They have incredible shamanic ability. But then, you know, as a shaman, they go and kill the whole next tribe because their love is refracted through ethnocentric consciousness.
Correct.
So that love is, right, we understand in our world is insufficient. We actually need to up-level our consciousness, right, and let love speak through those prisms. Mm-hmm. So with that as our goal in this conversation, what we'd like to do is actually, you know, go and walk with Deepak through the stages in the unfolding path of love that emerges both from Deepak's own first-person realization and experience, that emerges from his reverential receiving, and you feel that reverential receiving in the book, The Path to Love, which was just really delightful, right, to feel that kind of deep receiving of the tradition and then evolving the tradition. You know, you feel in your book, Deepak, both that wonderful, you know, receptivity of any true devotee and the kind of audacious evolutionary impulse to receive, transmute, and transform, right, in the very process of not only translating the teaching, but actually evolving the teaching. So with that as a context and with a delicious excitement, right, let's begin and walk through, right, these stages. So the first stage that you talked about, and every once in a while I'll ask a question, you know, get to the next stage, throw in some Kabbalistic Hasidic master, and then, you know, guide us along. But the person you're all here to listen to today is Deepak, and let's really go with him through the stages. So stage one is attraction, noticing.
Yeah, so, you know, when we are attracted to someone, it's not that we consciously chose to be attracted. There's something that happens. And I'm using, as I said, romantic love right now as the model, mm-hmm. but you could apply it to anything. So let's open with that caveat.
Okay.
But now, since we're using this model, when you're attracted to someone, there's a reason you're attracted to that person, because in the end, you know, we are living in this world without the ability to see ourselves. You know, the only person we can't actually see is ourselves, and I'm talking physiologically.
Mm-hmm.
You can only see yourself when you're looking at a mirror. And as you know, from the perspective of Advaita Vedanta, the world is a mirror, but so mm-hmm. are other people a mirror. We are the eyes of the universe looking at ourselves through so-called other people, because my eyes mm-hmm. are the body of the universe. And when I look at you, you are also the body of the universe. So I am the universe looking at itself through this interesting play, Leela.
Mm.
And therefore, when I'm attracted to you, what is really happening, or attracted to anyone, what is really happening is I am noticing qualities in that person which I have, but they remind me of what more I want. And similarly, if I am distressed by a person, and especially if that distress is emotional, and all distress ultimately becomes emotional, not just the psychological discomfort, but I am distressed because I'm finding in you the qualities that I'm denying in myself. So if I just remember that one principle, that those that I'm attracted to, those that I'm distressed by, are both mirrors of myself. I'm attracted to those people in whom I find traits that I have but want more of. I'm distressed by those people in whom I find traits that I have but I haven't actually paid attention to them, and I'm denying them. And so now, you know, this is a mirror. This is the mirror of relationship, another expression that Krishnamurti used, and the mirror of relationship is meant to take me to a higher level of consciousness. Now, what's the practical benefit of this? Here's the practical benefit. I see somebody that attracts me. I ask myself, what are the qualities that are attracting me? Whatever they are, you know, enthusiasm, joy, kindness, passionate, or whatever. I might want to write them down. And then there's somebody that really distresses me. And, you know, they're belligerent and egocentric and harsh and impatient. I write them down and mix them up and say, hey, this is who I am. And then, you know, the deeper understanding is that to have these positive and negative traits is not to be flawed, but to be complete, because our very soul is arising from a place of contradiction and paradox and ambiguity. And there would be no contrast if we did not have these traits. In fact, if I was always positive all the time, you'd find me exasperating. Mm-hmm. And if I was negative always, you'd find me tiresome as well. But the fact that I bounce around in all these different flavors of experience makes me interesting. In fact, there's a saying that I heard from Nisargadatta once, who said, the measure of your enlightenment is the degree that you're comfortable with paradox and contradiction and ambiguity. So if I embrace that in myself, then I don't feel, first of all, the need to judge myself. And if I'm not judging myself, then I'm not judging others. I'm less self-righteous in my morality. I'm not, you know, like the Catholic Church, which condemns homosexuality as a sin and then hides pedophiles in its own clergy. So,
right.
You know, what I'm saying is, if you can kind of, can you radiate that simple, unaffected humanity by embracing all your flaws and all your traits, then you're on a learning journey. You say, okay, this fine person I find very attractive. Am I going to borrow their attractive qualities, or am I going to become their attractive qualities? Because it feels good to be in the presence of this person because, you know, I can absorb that wonderful energy. But after a while, if I keep borrowing it, the person will get tired and say, you know, go your way. So instead of borrowing those traits from my friend, I start to become those. And instead of denying those traits from my so-called enemy, I start to notice how they can also be apparent when I'm under stress. And now I'm a simple, unaffected person who's not putting on a social mask, and that actually finds me on the path to unfoldment, because I find that people like me more than they did before I was trying to be good all the time, and also trying to pretend that I was good all the time. And now I'm natural. So I think this is the first stage where you attract gestures of love, you respond to gestures of love, you are attentive to what's happening around you, and you slowly begin to unfold from the first stage into the second stage, because most people will get to the second stage, it's inevitable, but they have a hard time because they're always trying to be good.
Right. So this first stage, which is just, fantastically exciting description and you know, just the practical applications that you wove in, you know, are infinitely valuable for everyone listening. And I want to pick up just on a couple of pieces of it. Again, that's my job here, just to kind of reflect out a couple of pieces. So one, you know, you cited the great Indian sage, you know, with the wonderful insight that enlightenment is, or the measure of enlightenment is in some sense measured by paradox, or the ability to hold paradox or to hold ambiguity. And I want to actually delightfully now cite, because since I spent, you know, till late last night, like 4 a.m, reading your book,
I
now know it better than you do, at least this for this hour, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So there's a wonderful quote there, which is, let me just kind of find it, kind of scrolling down here. I wrote it down at about 3:30 a.m, and I was I thought it was so, just such a great quote, which really is about, you know, love being deeply connected to your ability to hold your own ambiguity. Mm-hmm. You know, your ability to hold your own ambiguity, to hold the paradox of yourself, right? To truly, you know, hold that in a deep way. You know, and I think the exact quote was something like, the miracle of love is that you can be imperfect, right, and still be completely whole. Or something like, and again, I'm not finding the quote, but I'm remembering from 3:30 a.m, being lovable, here it is. Being lovable means being comfortable at home in your own ambiguity. Mm-hmm. You know, and I just thought, you know.
That's the place of creativity.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that was just
certainty
wonderful.
Certainty and dogma robs us of our creativity. And that
really
should be actually the unfoldment of creativity as well.
Yeah, and so we'll get to that, and just to stay in that beautiful quote, you know, to really just hear that, and to everyone just kind of, you know, embody and feel it, to be at home in your own ambiguity, not as a freeing, not as a new age kind of freeing, right, of your evolutionary responsibility. It's not about that at all, right? It's about actually really being able to embrace the paradox of yourself, and it brings to mind a teaching from the ancient Hebrew wisdom book, Sefer HaYetzirah, the first Kabbalistic book, which says there's not 5 but 12 faculties of perception, and the 12th one is laughter. Right? And laughter allows you to kind of, it's a faculty of sense perception, because it allows you to access the inner state of reality in a way that nothing else quite does. And in what way? Because laughter allows you to hold paradox.
That's beautiful. That's very
yeah.
beautiful, because, you know, can I tell, am I allowed to?
Please,
tell
no, absolutely. No, we like jokes.
Okay. So,
laughter.
You know, this fellow goes to hell, and the devil is showing him around, and he sees this 98-year-old codger with a 23-year-old beautiful girl on his lap, and he says, that doesn't look like hell to me. And the devil says, it is, for the girl. So that just that shift in perspective, you know, in that 1 second, that shift in perspective allows you to see the paradox of the situation.
And that's
so
laughter.
I think a joke is, in fact, comfort with paradox. When my soul recognizes the paradox and contradiction and ambiguity, it laughs. And laughing brings me closer to the divine in me. If I have to explain a joke to you, then of course it's not a joke.
And there's a certain trust. I remember when I first, it was a decade ago, and I was kind of deeply caught up in writing a series of, you know, books on unpacking Kabbalistic tradition to Western consciousness. And someone gave me a book of Ken's, and I think it was actually the big one. It was the first big one, Sex, Ecology, and Spirituality. And the reason and I said this to Ken as we became close over the years, the reason I trusted the book is because there's an underlying quality in Ken's writing where he's laughing.
Yes.
Right? And that's, you know, he's got that, and that quality made me trust him, you know, because he was able to, you felt him, you know, in these kind of little throwaway lines, you know, in the footnotes and in the book, you felt the laughter. And it was that same quality that I was feeling as I read, you know, late at night last night, I was reading through The Path to Love. You know, I felt an enormous gravitas and seriousness and a laughter. It was that same quality through the book.
Thank you.
Well, no, so thank you for that. And from that place, right, to just, you know, unpack one more thing implicit in, you know, the stage of attraction and what is the attraction that happens and how does attraction happen. In some sense, you really explained and explaining so precisely the dynamics of attraction, what's actually happening, that level of awareness that you brought to it, explains another idea dancing in the world of Kabbalah, that when people are attracted to each other, there's actually a tikkun, a unique fixing that they have to do together in the world. And so you actually explained in some sense the dynamics of that fixing. Right, now that you could actually bring that tradition to bear to really, right, explain that. So now that we know that we're attracted to each other because we each have something of each other's story, we each have a gift to give to each other, we now need to move past the first stage of attraction to the stage of second attention, right, sometimes called infatuation.
Yeah. Well, in Western traditions, it's called infatuation, or it's the closest word I could find, because the word fatuous means to be silly. And we frequently say of infatuated lovers how silly they are, because they see something that we don't see. And, you know, from a spiritual point of view, what they're seeing, they're having a quality of attention, which is called second attention, which is they see beyond the obvious. And so, you know, second attention can express itself in many ways. When you feel safe in the midst of danger, when you think of someone and they call you, when are getting beyond a selfish attachment, at least glimpsing it, when somebody has a spontaneous remission in a disease, and I'll talk about how love does that biologically if you want, second attention is also intuition, it's insight. And it is a quality that lovers spontaneously have when they move to the second stage. That's why other people can't see what they see in each other, because in a deeper way, they've glimpsed each other's soul. Now, if we think of the soul as our core consciousness, and therefore more in the realm of the transpersonal or transcendent, or as these days we would say, in the realm of entanglement in physics, or we would say non-local correlation, then it's easy to say why second attention brings those experiences. Feeling the presence of someone next to you, even though they're in space-time, they're far away. And infatuated people in that second stage of love have all of that. And, you know, they have three qualities that are more dominant in them. And they begin all with A. That's how I now remember when I was writing the book. Attention, appreciation, and affection. So let's go over all those three. Attention means that they have a deep listening. They spontaneously have a deep listening to what's each other is not only saying, but they have a deep listening of the other person's needs. And this, I think, is a listening not only with the eyes of the flesh and the eyes of the mind and the eyes of the heart, but from the soul, this deep listening. The second quality that they have is appreciation, in that they notice the strengths of the other person, and they, for the moment at least, are happy to overlook the shadows, the weaknesses. And that's why, you know, when you see two people who are intensely in love or infatuated and they point out a flaw in the other person, and the person who's in love will totally ignore that, you know. They only notice the strengths and the good qualities. And then
that's
the
what Blake was talking about. Love to faults is always blind. He must have been talking about that stage.
That is it. And then the third is they have affection. And, you know, this affection is very spontaneous. It's the kind of affection that a mother has for a baby. You know, when you see the mother holding her baby, she coos and cuddles and touches and kisses and says sweet nothings to her baby. And infatuated lovers start to do the same thing. They coo and cuddle and they say meaningless things to each other, and yet there is immense delight in every sentence that is uttered, no matter how silly it is or no matter how meaningless it is to others. And this is a shift in attention. This is an expansion of consciousness, and it creates a very intoxicated feeling. So I would say infatuation is almost a feeling of the intoxication of love, which expresses itself in this awareness of our non-local domain, which, as we use the word entanglement or correlated, and therefore it's actually a physiological state. And, you know, as a physician, I study people who have remissions and so on, and I'm finding more and more that when they are experiencing the intoxication of love, and other things also, that their physiology actually turns to maximizes self-repair mechanisms.
Wow.
Which is the opposite of what your physiology does when you're stressed.
Right.
So, you know, I was thinking to myself that all these years we have focused on the physiology of stress, but we've never actually focused on the biology of love. And it turns out that all the research is showing that self-repair mechanisms get activated, homeostasis gets activated. It's a very dynamic state of self-repair, which is why people feel healing. And in fact, this may be the common factor in healing. If I can just mention, anyone who's listening, I've just done a series of videos with an institution called the Visual MD. So if you go on the website, the Visual MD just released a video on the biology of love with some spectacular pictures, imaging through PET scans and so on, of what is happening in the biology when love is flowing.
That's fantastic. And we will, Kelly, who is listening, right, who's running the series for us, will absolutely post that, you know, on the Facebook page so people will be able to get there. And what you've all just heard in this second stage is this incredible description of this first stage of falling in love. And I just want to note that what Deepak is saying here, this is not a casual given that this is true. That is to say, there's an enormous plethora. When I wrote my book on loving called The Mystery of Love, right, I read through, you know, like you always do, you know, 30, 40 books on, you know, and just what was out there, what were people saying. And what I was struck by was maybe, you know, 28 out of the 30 said, well, falling in love, that's a false experience. Right, and the real work of loving begins when you fall out of love. Now, that's, of course, a partial truth, but it ignores everything that Deepak just said, which is that actually in the state of infatuation, there's something unbelievably important happening, and you actually begin to see here the initial perception. Love is a perception, as a shift in attention. The Kabbalists call everything that Deepak said in two Aramaic words, itaruta de la'ela, arousal from above. And if I was a good Kabbalist, I would say that we just heard one of the most stunning unpackings of arousal from above, you know, in so many of its multifaceted pieces, that actually this is real. Even though it goes away, something that goes away is actually a free gift of the cosmos. It's a free download, right? But you got to use it, you know, in order for you to actually, you know, learn how to use that software. But the free download's real. It's this arousal from above and in all of its states of, and we had three stages there. We had attention, you know, appreciation, right, and affection. But at a certain point, right, you know, something happens, right, and infatuation doesn't retain its next, right, its easy or gift power. And so I think we're about to come to the next stage, which in Deepak's unfolding of the path, right, is courtship.
Yeah, and since I wrote the book, I changed that to communion more than anything else.
I'm going to let you do that here because I'm a very nice guy. Okay.
Yeah, because the reason infatuation doesn't last long is self-concern and self-importance creeps in. There's a fear. How long is this going to last? Is the other person going to pay attention to me? And so, you know, what started off as a gift to an invitation to a higher reality now brings you back. And then, of course, there's the loss of that feeling and almost an anxiety that comes with it and sometimes a return to a state which is worse, which is, you know, why we see so frequently when people have bitter divorce or whatever, they don't even remember these happy experiences. They're so overshadowed by their own self-concern and their own self-importance, which, as you know, Castaneda and others have said, is just self-pity in disguise. Mm. And so the self-pity takes over and you lose the magic. Now, if you're aware, of course, and you understand that people have navigated this territory before many times and we can learn from their experiences, instead of calling this third stage courtship, why don't we call it communion? Because it's a deeper communion, not connection, although there's a dance involved, with the word courtship implies the dance. It's really soul connecting to soul. And when we examine, you know, most people, by the way, do not get to this stage, unfortunately, in our society, because we are so used and programmed and indoctrinated into the idea of instant gratification. And now that we've lost the magic, then, you know, we say, oh my God, that was just illusion or something, it wasn't real. When in fact, every stage of love is meant to awaken us to a higher, more aware consciousness. If you want to move into sobriety from the intoxication, but yet want to maintain that feeling of joy that you have experienced in the first two stages, then the third stage of communion requires that once and for all, you recognize that at the level of consciousness, at the level of our ground being, of being, at the level of our core consciousness, so if you want to use the word soul, we are equal. The relationship or the any relationship in order to evolve to this next stage cannot be based on superiority or inferiority, because superiority does imply inferiority. And so where relationships falter now at the third stage is that, you know, one person starts to feel more important than the other in the relationship. So equality is absolutely necessary. The other thing is the experience that, you know, these days social scientists are talking about spiritual intelligence, which means to be totally in touch with your feelings, not necessarily having the need to explain them, because as we've already said, feelings can be paradoxical and contradictory. You're experiencing joy and you're experiencing anxiety at the same time. So instead of trying to analyze the feelings, to just feel them, but also feel the other person's feelings, which in the language of spiritual intelligence is to feel what the other is feeling without trying to understand what the other is feeling. Because understanding, again, brings in the intellect. And then, you know, frequently you'll hear when relationships go wrong, the person says, I don't understand why you're feeling like that. When in fact, the person who's feeling like that doesn't understand why they're feeling like that also. So
they certainly can't explain it.
Yeah, can't explain it. So forget trying to explain it. Embrace what you're feeling. Feel what the other person is feeling. And be very delicate at this stage about being in any way too analytical, because it's a delicate stage. Soul is communing with soul. Equality, empathy, and I would say the third ingredient would be integrity. Do not do something that takes away the trust that is slowly coming in this stage. So, you know, anytime you're deceptive or lying or hiding something, you're not going to progress to the next stage of awakening, because it implies integrity. So to summarize, I would say equality, deep empathy and comfort, not analyzing too much, and being careful that you speak the truth and you walk the truth.
So this second stage...
Thank you.
I was doing
since you're talking about the map.
Absolutely. No. It's all my students know that I always get the number wrong, and they always send me an email.
In the end, it's not important, you know.
So it's a third stage, absolutely. So we've walked through the first stage of attraction, right? We've walked through infatuation, and now we've just described the third stage, which Deepak initially described as courtship, and actually in the book itself, remember, because I'm the person who's read it last, right?
Yeah.
So you actually use communion actually there, right,
okay,
in the conversation in the third stage, although you called it courtship, but communion was already bubbling in you then.
Okay.
And the description here is, and the description I really want to focus on this stage, because what often happens, as Deepak is sharing with us, is that a person loses the infatuation stage and then basically spends their whole life, okay, finding it again, then losing it, finding it again, then losing it, and life becomes a dance, right, between attraction and infatuation, and people rarely, you know, get to this third stage where they're beginning to dance in communion. And part of the reason is because it's hard to let go, right, of that incredible feeling of infatuation. And I'm remembering a stage of infatuation here. I must have been, you know, 20 years ago, and it was the first 2 months of the relationship, maybe 25 years ago, and our car had broken down. And we were going in Midtown Manhattan to get the car, and it was just like late at night, you know, the car had broken down, had been towed, and it was 2 a.m, and a completely annoying activity. And we just noted to each other, we just realized that at that stage of the relationship, getting the car together and making love were basically the same activity. It didn't matter. I mean, I'm like, oh, my God, who wouldn't want to go back there? But, of course, we can get back there. We do get back there. We get back there as we're going to progress the Deepak stages, but we get back there from a different place. So what Deepak is saying is we need to first transcend this second stage, but the way he's saying transcend is what I would call transcend, right, to end the trance of the second stage, but to actually take with us some of its sweetness, right, some of its inspiration, because actually we'd never get to three if not for the sweetness of the second.
Yeah, I mean, remember, in the second stage is when people write poems and things like that, you know.
Yeah, no, it's a great stage. So we don't want to lose it all together. We want to transcend it. We want to end the trance and then begin doing this work, you know, of deep integrity, which is, you know, moving towards genuine knowing, you know, on a different level. I just remember, and this is going to move us into the next stage, the fourth stage. You know, we're moving from Blake, you know, love to a fault, you know, to fault is always blind, you know, to Emily Dickinson, you know, her beautiful idea of, you know, not revelation tis that waits, you know, but our unfurnished eyes, you know, that actually we're starting to see each other. We're starting to actually see something in each other. We're trying to see each other, right, in an even deeper way than the gorgeous seeing. We're adding on levels of perception here, which takes us, which prepares us to really go to the next stage. And the next stage after communion, right, would be?
The next stage after communion is intimacy.
Is intimacy.
As you know, we've prepared for intimacy. Intimacy is a very vulnerable stage. And if you haven't carefully navigated the stage of communion, which involves not only total empathy, but also involves getting in touch with each other's feelings, but it also involves trust, remember?
Trust.
Integrity. So if you have not navigated that in the delicate manner, then true intimacy is not possible. You know, people think, oh, I had sex, so I was intimate. And
right.
One of the things that always surprised me when I watch movies, for example, is after sex, the person says, do you love me? It's kind of the other way around, you know. You've had the experience of intimacy, so-called, and then you're still seeking reassurance,
right.
Or do you love me, or, you know, or you say, I love you, as if you need to. So
right.
True intimacy is not just, you know, being naked physically, but naked in every level of your being. So, you know, what Rumi has a beautiful poem where he says, if you're not naked by now, go back to sleep. And I love that poem because it's so beautiful. He's talking about, you know, he's talking about exposing your soul. And if you don't expose your soul, you're not ready for awakening. It's such a beautiful one sentence. He says it all. If you're not naked by now, go back to sleep. So intimacy involves shedding your ego in that relationship completely and totally. It involves being exposed. It involves being being vulnerable. It actually involves not having any more secrets, and it allows you to go into a place of timelessness.
Mm-hmm.
And and freedom, and you know, when you look at something as physiological as a sexual orgasm, for example,
mm-hmm.
you see that there's a glimpse of this. You know, when people are in the peak experience of sexuality, they are defenseless. At
mm-hmm.
that moment, there is no ego, and at that moment, hopefully, you're not looking at your watch.
Right.
So you
Hopefully.
Are experiencing timelessness, you are
mm-hmm.
totally defenseless, you
mm-hmm.
are vulnerable, you have at that moment no secrets. Now imagine if that could be your state of consciousness all along, you
mm-hmm.
would be in that state all along. So, you know, intimacy is as the first glimpse of, hey, this is what moksha is, this is what freedom is. I don't have to defend anything, I am not time-bound. And in exposing myself completely, I have awakened to my soul.
The intimacy. I mean, this fourth stage of intimacy. And you notice that I got the number right this time. I wanted to
yes.
make sure everybody was paying attention to that on the call. So intimacy, this fourth stage, right, brings us to, and you know, moksha, right? It brings us to the beginning, or perhaps you might say an early stage of moksha, the
mm-hmm.
beginning of a potential liberation. And not by accident, right, at this stage, right, images of sexuality begin to enter our conversation. And I'm sure that everybody noticed that. Now, of course, you know, the way that it often unfolds, right, in the contemporary context, right, is never linear, right? And as
mm-hmm.
we know,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
you know, it just doesn't always happen that way. And sometimes sex happens too late, and other times it happens too early.
Yeah.
You know, we all remember when Harry meets Sally. You know, when they're afraid to have sex because, as Deepak says, they're afraid that that's going to explode something that's building. But let's just look at sexuality now. Let's look at this Kama Sutra. Let's look at this kind of deep desire, right, that plays in the world of intimacy and try and understand how this plays. You know, in the arc above the temple in Jerusalem, in this mystery tradition called Secret of the Cherubs, the two cherubs are actually, you know, according to the Talmud and Eruvin 54a, are actually sexually intertwined. So you've got this incredible mystery symbol in the temple in Jerusalem, in the Sanctum Sanctorum, of intimacy. You know, the
mm-hmm.
cherubs are the symbol of, you know, sexually intertwined cherubs. And in the teaching that I'm hearing that you're giving that really resonates so deeply with what we know from modern psychology and with the old Kabbalistic traditions, the sexual here, as it were, models eros, or it models holiness. It doesn't exhaust eros. It doesn't exhaust holiness. The sexual becomes a place which holds out an almost symbolic, incarnate expression of what might be. I mean, in sex, giving and receiving become one, right? In sex, right. We give up control, right? In sex, you know, the power of imagination works. That all of these things that happen in sexing, you know, imaginal power, giving and receiving, giving up control, radical giving, you know, all of that, you know, being on the inside, fullness of presence, yearning, that all of that, you know, models, right, what we might want to actually create in our non-sexual intimacy at the fourth stage. Does that resonate with you?
It does, and I think we have to also recognize that somehow, you know, for whatever bizarre reason, religious institutions generally have policed sex, and they've become kind of, you know, people who decide that sex is sinful and somehow false or ugly and unchaste, when in fact the sexual experience is meant to take us to the experience of holiness and beauty and joy. So the first idea is, you know, suppression of sex or the sexual impulse is false, ugly, and unchaste. Of course, you have to find the right channel for its expression.
The right context.
But
it
is the repression of sex that causes deviancy and pathology in society, not the expression of sex. I think anything that we can call a sexual crime, but even otherwise, things like the feeling of impotence or frustration in general, or the feeling of rage, or the feeling this yearning for power, that is, you know, ego power, it all comes from the suppression of sexual energy, which is the creative energy of the universe. Think of anything that's alive; it has sexual energy. So I would say that sexual energy and spiritual energy are almost synonymous, mm-hmm. except, you know, they find different expressions. You know, one is making communion with the divine, and the other is seeking union through a carnal expression of the divine as well. Once we get there, then we get rid of certain things that are holding back our sexuality. And when we express our sexuality in healthy ways and the right channeling of it, it actually accelerates our evolution towards enlightenment. One has to get rid of the idea that there's anything false or ugly or unchaste about it. One has to get rid of the idea of suppressing it. And then one has to find the right context in which to express it. Because it's some people will channel their sexual energy into great experience of art or music or dance or movement or architecture. There's nothing more sexual than a beautiful sculpture or even the Sistine Chapel, for that matter. Some people will express it and strengthen their bond of love, and some people will find holiness in the experience.
And so this core energy, so that you're mapping two stages. One is which is no small piece of work in Western culture, because of all of the influences that formed the kind of Platonic, you know, churched Western mind, is to really free yourself. And that's real work. That's real psychological work, to free yourself of the sense that they're actually the kind of hidden anti-sexual bias in culture. And that just needs to be actually really cleansed and purified and Kabbalah clarified, right, to clarify that, the clarification of desire. And two is to find the right context. And the right context, and that context, you know, may be romantic, and it may be creative, right, and it may be, you know, chanting, you know, and it may be, you know, all of those. It may be Mother Teresa loving, you know, Jesus in all of his discretionary disguises, but all of those are actually expressions, right, of that core energy. And from that place, we come to intimacy, right? Mm-hmm. From the place of really internalizing that, you're describing to us what intimacy can actually become and be.
Right. Correct.
Okay.
I mean, you know, you mentioned Mother Teresa. She comes, they're called the handmaidens of Jesus. They're brides of Jesus.
Right.
So there's that underlying that underlying theos, if you will, you know, motif.
Yeah, there. Yeah. Yeah, you know, there's I remember when I was young, there's an old Talmudic passage that talks about Akiva, the great lover, right, in the Talmud, describing the Book of Solomon, Song of Songs, and he says that, Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs, is a mashal, is an allegory. So the way they always would explain that was, well, it's not really about sexuality, because the Song of Songs, which allegorizes everything in terms of sensual passion, it's not really about sexuality, it's really about loving God.
Yeah.
And of course, what Solomon really means is, it's an allegory, meaning sexuality holds in it, right, the great teaching, and incarnates, right, everything that, loving God and loving everything really is in all of its levels.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing more beautiful than the Songs of Solomon, you know?
Oh, my God, yeah. And so those are our two cherubs in the temple. So our two cherubs and all of the two cherubs that are listening, you know, out there, although we're talking in the framework, right, of romantic love, right, but this framework actually is a teaching, right, for all, right, forms of love. And it's love of friendship, right? It's love of family. It's, right, it's brother love. It's all of the loves that, you know, that Rama and Sita and Rama's brother and all those, right, and Krishna and the handmaidens, it's all happening together with us. And so from that place of intimacy, right, and we've actually deepened into that place, and sexuality in that sacred context is just the holy of holies, right? We then kind of open to the next stage, right, which is surrender.
Yeah, now surrender, again, this is an unfolding, you know, surrender, which is the same thing as non-attachment or, in a sense, detachment. But, you know, when people hear the word detachment, they get worried. How can you love and be detached at the same time? But it's a deeper detachment. I would say the easiest way to understand it is there is no self-concern. There is no self-importance. There is no self-pity. There is allowing. So there's a spontaneous evolution to a state where you do not feel the need to judge or label or define or analyze or insist or beg or seduce. The allowing is all that's needed. The being is all that needed. And it is getting now very close to the choiceless awareness that Krishnamurti spoke of. You're almost living at the edge of choiceless awareness and subtle intention. This is a very powerful state to be in, you know, because when you have choiceless awareness and subtle intention, then the intention from that level orchestrates its own fulfillment almost teleologically. That, you know, in fact, you know, what I find distressing with all the recent literature on the law of attraction is it's so superficially understood, and the word law of attraction has become very popular because now you can attract Mercedes and bank accounts and things like that, when in fact this is the mechanics of creation, that at that cusp of choiceless awareness and what we call sankalp in Sanskrit, which is that subtle intention and letting go. So, you know, it's understanding context, it's refraining from labeling, defining, and all that I mentioned. It's having a subtle intention. It's being grounded in love and letting the intention orchestrate creativity inside, and also creativity in the so-called world outside, which is a projection of the world inside. And in my experience, this translates into synchronicity and meaningful coincidences and a kind of a magical quality that life acquires in this state of surrender.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you. So this is, thank you for that beautiful description, as all of them have been. And just you know, just a moment of gratitude, you know, on behalf of everyone on the line, you know, that your every line is kind of limbed with your life's work and your just complete evolutionary passion for taking both the great ideas and evolving them and sharing them in a way that people can actually find their way in. And, you know, we don't spend enough time on gratitude. So just a moment of gratitude from, you know, all 12,000 people who signed up for the series, for your being here with us and for your coming to Integral Spiritual Experience coming up in Asilomar, right, in a few months. You know, 33 countries, you'll be there with Deepak. He's going to be giving a lead keynote address. He'll be taking questions afterwards, and he's going to be doing a rock show. He's a rock star. He hasn't shared that from 12 to 4 in the morning, but no one knows that. Don't let anyone know. We're very excited. We're hoping that your wife will be coming with you. Please extend.
She might, depends, you know, on what else is happening in the family, but we understand
that there's heavy competition, but we're gonna try. So let me go back to this stage of surrender. Okay, and let's just think into this, and I want to introduce something to you, Deepak, that we've been thinking about in the integral world for the last 5 or 6 years. I actually just completed the first book on it called The New Enlightenment: Awakening the Unique Self, that Ken wrote the introduction to, and it's about this thing that I've developed together with Ken, and many other people have made, you know, pivotal contributions: Dan Mushel Hamilton, Brother David Stendel Rast, Sally Kempton, you know, a whole host of other fabulous people. But the idea is, right, is that at a particular stage of consciousness, at this place when synchronicity begins to play, when this magic that you so eloquently describe begins to be at play, there's something that emerges post-classical enlightenment. Right, post the enlightenment of eternity and the realization of your oneness with all that is, that you're part of the seamless code of the universe, you actually realize in some way post-ego, it's not an egoic realization, it's a post-transcendent realization, that you're actually a unique self, that your enlightenment has a perspective, right? That actually, you know, your true self plus your perspective actually yields your unique self, and your unique self creates evolutionary obligation, right? That evolutionary obligation is the expression of the active force in love in you, right, spontaneously, you know, as the Buddhist would say, the free flow functioning mind, you know, kind of acting in the world, you know, almost as God, right? You actually feel God acting in you, as you, and through you, right? And the world responds to you, and you respond to it with an enormous sense of actually obligation, that actually at this point, obligation comes back online. It's not a mythic obligation. And actually in Hebrew, in the original Hebrew, the word for obligation, the word for love, chova and chiba, are actually the same word. And my sense is, and I want to just offer it to you and hear your response or deepening, that in the levels you're describing, it's at this place, right, that the idea of unique self post-ego, right, acting with evolutionary consciousness and obligation might actually come online, and that actually obligation in no way contradicts surrender. You surrender to your highest obligation as a unique self. Does that resonate, play?
It does, with one little possible addendum, that your unique self is a part, I'm glad you used the word post-egoic, your unique self is a pattern of behavior of the universal, and being a pattern of behavior of the universal, your unique self wants to take the responsibility to align itself with that evolutionary impulse. And that is the responsibility that you spontaneously embrace, not out of a sense of obligation, but it's your nature now to want to embrace that responsibility.
Which may be the highest obligation, right, is to actually realize your true nature. Right,
yes.
In its deepest place. And from that place, we perhaps, and this is the last question I'm going to ask Deepak before we go to the last two stages, which we're going to do together, and then we're going to take questions, right, before we go to passion and ecstasy, which are distinct, but we'll try and see them together given our time constraint. I want to, Deepak, before that last stage, ask you a last question and introduce perhaps emerging out of the stage of surrender and out of this unique self pattern, which fulfills its own highest obligation, but this kind of arising universe in me that needs to express, which is God expressing in me, what then begins to emerge is a new understanding of love, that, or at least a new understanding of what it might mean in the old words to love God. That to love God actually means, in some sense, to let God see through my eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Right? To let
yes,
God see.
Absolutely.
Right.
You become the eyes of the universe and you become the thoughts of the universe. In Sanskrit, there are two Sanskrit expressions that explain this. One is called Ritam Bhara Pragya. Ritam is the Sanskrit word for rhythm or symphony. And Bhara Pragya means my consciousness is saturated now with the symphony of the universe, which is, you know, orchestrating an infinity of space-time events all simultaneously. The other is the other Sanskrit word that describes this is dharma, that the elements and forces in my unique self are aligned with the elements and forces of the cosmos. So I'm now the instrument of the cosmos to fulfill its dharma. And that's
the level of surrender. That's not before surrender. That's the level you're describing as surrender.
Yes, it is surrender.
Oh, that's fantastic. And to hear that, you know, from your tradition and that particular was for me, you know, just completely worth, you know, every, you know, the call was all fantastic, but just to hear that, I'm going to find you and hear more about that. So what this teaching is, it's just such a beautiful teaching, and it just, you know, when you get up in the morning and you wonder about, like, why am I getting up, and I'm lost in this postmodern context of meaninglessness, and you realize that actually, that to be a devotee is actually nothing but actually being him,
yes,
from a distinct perspective that no one else has.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And it's about, you know, in some sense that if we're really successful, right, in reaching surrender, so our mm-hmm. perspective becomes available to God and mm-hmm. feeds God and feeds God's work.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what a feeling to get up with in the morning out of mm-hmm. this ultimate meaning, you know, alive in me, and to really, I mean, throw the Prozac out. Oh my God!
Mm-hmm.
I mean, unless, and by the way, I don't want to be light about that. You know, Prozac's important. It's a fantastic upper right tool. So please.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the place of love. You know, which actually brings us. You know, which emerges from the stage that Deepak's calling surrender. Your unique self comes online, and we come really to the pinnacle, right, of passion and ecstasy.
Yes, in our society, many people confuse passion with the second stage, infatuation. So,
right,
you know, which doesn't last very long. But true passion is inexhaustible. It's also irreversible. So it's, in Vedanta we say it's like a child that's born now cannot return to the womb. A new process has taken over, and it is irreversible. It is the awakening of the archetypal masculine and the feminine in you. So the archetypal masculine expresses itself as initiative and risk-taking, but more as strength and power. And the feminine archetype begins to awaken as beauty, intuition, nurturing, affection, tenderness. So imagine having immense power, initiative, and drive, which is at the same time balanced by this inner sense of beauty, truth, goodness, harmony, affection, tenderness, and nurturing. This is a passionate being, and this kind of passionate being has now passion for everything that life has to offer, and moreover, that this passion is irreversible, because it's not a put-on, it's not a make-believe, it's not, you know, that little intoxication that we experienced the first time. It's a permanent groundedness in the marriage of the archetypal feminine and the masculine in your own self. Now, you know, many people can embody this kind of passion. So, Madam, you know, there was a great saint in India, Meera, who embodied the passion of Krishna. And, you know, anytime we talk about mythical figures or religious figures, you can basically then be the instrument to incarnate them, whether it's Moses, which is the archetypal masculine, or, you know, it's Mother Mary, the archetype of the Christian feminine, or it is any of the gods and goddesses of the Greek pantheon of gods and goddesses, or the gods and goddesses of the Hindu tradition. You're not talking about external beings, but you're talking about symbolic expressions that archetypally express a certain energy or information state. Not external beings, but they have the ability to empower you in a way that is extraordinary, so that you become capable of doing extraordinary things. I think any time we see an Obama or a great leader emerge, or a great religious leader emerge, mm-hmm. or anytime we imagine in our mythology supernatural beings, these are actually symbolic expressions of higher states of consciousness where we can encapsulate an entire theme or a motif of a story and then give it physical form, because we are coming from a place of passion.
Right, passion, which is really the highest or the higher reaches of unique self.
Yes.
You know, which really comes, you know, and incarnates in this incredible way. The Judah personality, right, mm-hmm. would be that kind of...
You know, if you read all the characters in the Old Testament, every one of them is an archetypal embodiment of, whether it's you're talking about Joseph and his dreams, or you're talking about Moses, or you're talking about Aaron, or you're talking any of those characters, and also the women characters, Rebecca, etc. They're
Absolutely.
All embodying these archetypal themes.
That's right, and to be able to access these people, you know, in the first person, to actually feel Judah and Rebecca
exactly.
speaking in you and through you, actually brings, you know, not the fundamentalist Bible, but biblical consciousness, right, and that text back online, which is one of the strands that weaves Western esotericism that we need. And that, and on that ecstatic thought, I want to ask you to kind of talk about the last, right, the last, and of course, none of these are precisely hierarchical, but they do unfold in a mature
they
way.
They do
in the way,
unfold.
They do
well,
unfold.
Well, the last stage is
ecstasy,
and you know, ecstasy is an interesting word in English, because ektasis means to step out, to be
right.
beyond, to transcend. So last stage is also this place where we came from. You know, when T.S. Eliot says, "We shall not cease from exploration, the end of our exploring is to arrive where we started from and know the place for the first time." So, you know, in as I understand it, ecstasy is physical, it's mythical, and then it's sacred. The physical ecstasy is the experience of the sensual universe through all our senses. Every sense is delight. The mythical ecstasy is the complete awakening of these archetypal characters that exist inside us. And we, of course, are partial to some of them. I grew up with Buddha and Jesus and, you know, those characters. But it could be anybody that starts mm-hmm. to embody themselves through you. And sacred ecstasy is, of course, direct union with the divine. So when we have physical, mythical, and sacred ecstasy, then we have returned home. It's the return of the memory of wholeness, and it's holy, and you are healed. Now, there is a passage which I cannot track right now that is from the, it's attributed to the Old Testament, but is not found in the Bible. Somebody sent it to me, and I actually went to, I went to Israel, I went to, you know, Masada and all those places
mm-hmm.
Where the Essenes lived. And apparently it comes from the Essenes, but it has a very
really?
Old Testament flavor. And it is very similar to the Songs of Solomon. I'd like to close with that.
Please.
It says, "You split me and you tore my heart open and you filled me with love. You poured your spirit into mine. I knew you as I know myself. My eyes are radiant with your light. My ears delight in your music. My nostrils are filled with your fragrance. My face is covered with your dew. You have made me see all things shining. You have made me see all things new. You have granted me perfect ease, and I have become like paradise. And having become like paradise, my soul is healed." In that one passage, and I don't know where it comes from, it comes from somewhere in Israel, in the Middle East, from those times, is actually the description of physical, mythical, and sacred ecstasy.
Ah, completely, completely beautiful passage, and it feels, you know, Middle Eastern, it feels biblical,
yes.
and it just washes through us, you know, on all levels. And at this point, you know, at this just, you know, beautiful place in the conversation where we've really together unfolded through at least a taste, right? We don't have the illusion, everyone on the phone, you know, delightful people, you know, thousands of just unique selves from all over the world, that we've exhausted this. We don't have the illusion that, you know, you can listen to this call and it's all worked out. But what Deepak was doing was perhaps we might call giving pointing out instructions from the Buddhist tradition, pointing out instructions in the first person, you know, in the second person, in the third person, that actually allow us, you know, to reconstruct a path which begins to open up the way. And that's enough for us. So at this point, we want to give you voice, right? We've gotten so many questions in on the webcast, and there's so many people live on the line. We have about 11 minutes left, and Deepak has a schedule today, and I know everyone else is going out for a beautiful afternoon, so we're going to stay in the time frame. So let me take at least a call or two, right, from around the world. There are people on the line. To get into the call, you press star 7. So star
Hello?
7. Yes, please. Go take it away. What's your name?
Timothy in California.
Timothy, take it away.
It was just wonderful, wonderful, about 10,000 times more. One comment, with Deepak, when you said that love is the pull to union, the thought that came to me that may be related to that is fear is the push to separation.
Mm. Correct. Correct. And that you know, that dance of opposites is in the universe, from the electrical charges of positive, negative, to the dance between the divine and the devil, the diabolical. It's the way creation is.
Mm. Mm. Thank you, Timothy. Thank you. Thank you for that deeper elucidation, and thank you. And anyone else? We'll take one or two more calls, and I will at least take a couple of webcast questions. So anyone else, star 7, welcome. Go ahead.
Thank you so much. I love the ability to hold one's own ambiguity and one's own paradox. That just clicked for me this morning.
Isn't it at 3:30 in the morning? That just blew me out of my seat.
Oh, my God.
Sentence.
And
absolutely.
It matches my meditation. I awoke.
But tell us your name. We need to tell us your name.
Oh, thank you. This is Melanie in Denver.
Melanie.
And there's another Rumi thing where he's talking about going from town to town, and he says, if you can't love, from tavern to tavern, he says, if you can't love, get out of town.
Yeah. Well, you know, you reminded me of another Rumi poem where he says, define me and label me, and you starve yourself of yourself. Nail me down in a box with cold words, and that box will be your coffin, because I do not know who I am. And then in the end, he says in the same poem, I'm your own voice echoing off the walls of God.
Oh,
mm,
God.
I'm your own voice echoing off the walls of God.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you, Melanie from Denver. Have a beautiful day.
Thanks very much.
Yes, yes. And let me take, and I know there's many people on the line, but I want to also just honor the webcast people and take a couple of people who have actually asked questions. So, Deepak, we have Antoinette from the Netherlands, right, who asked a question, which is really a voice from everybody. You know, how can you most effectively love someone who has put up walls of self-protection, right, to keep love out? So a word for Antoinette.
Yeah, do not get attached to transforming them. You do what you have to do, and then you leave the results to the unknown. Because if you try forcibly to change someone and they're not ready in their state of consciousness, it'll only create more distress.
Mm, thank you. Thank you. And we've got two questions of this nature coming up, and this is a question that I've heard many, many times in counseling over the last 25 years, right? Many people have a first-person experience of it, so I want to ask it from Jim, right, who's in Montana, right, and from Pamela, right, who is in France. And you're both asking essentially the same question, one from the masculine perspective, the other from the feminine. So with your permission, I'm going to recapitulate it for Deepak. What both Jim and Pamela are asking Deepak is the following. Each one describes a relationship in which they're with someone that they have a deep trust of, you know, it's lovely, they're committed to them, you know, they love them, and all the ways of having been together for many years, you know, and they've each met a person, right, in their, you know, one's in the workplace, another seems to be in another context, where there's this incredible electricity, right, and they kind of feel seen in a different way, and, you know, they have that stage of infatuation, right, that you were describing earlier, and they're caught between that, and then they're not quite sure how to navigate. They want to be loyal, and yet they want to you know, be able to respond to the infatuation. And since two people asked almost the exact same question, and I wanted to put that to you and hear your momentary wisdom on it.
Well, first caution is do not be impulsive. You'll regret your impulsivity no matter what happens. So take a little time to be still and silent and ask yourself what's going on. And then if you do decide to act on it, then be truthful to your partner, difficult though it may sound to be, because it is showing that you may have moved to a new stage in your relationship. But if you're not honest, if you don't have integrity, and you do not do this with caution and awareness and not recognize this is a very conscious choice you're making, you will regret in the long run.
Thank you. Thank you, thank you. And I think many people have been in this position, and some of us have done it right, some of us have done it wrong. Everybody gets a second and a tenth chance.
Yes.
You know, and just to,
absolutely.
You know, just yeah, absolutely. Just to
nothing wrong with falling down as long as you get up again.
As long as you get up again, right. Shiva nafal tzaddik vakam, the tzaddik, the righteous one, right, falls seven times and gets up. The wicked one falls once and never does.
That's
so we're nearing the end of our time, and what we're going to do is we're going to close with three things. All right, we're going to close first off with an announcement, right? Just a simple and sweet one, which is, again, and it's the third time I've said it, because good things come in holy trinities, right? We're looking forward to see you, Deepak, at the Integral Spiritual Experience at Asilomar, right, at the end of 2010. Deepak will be giving the lead keynote, be taking questions afterwards, and really on behalf of the whole Integral Evolutionary Tribe. Right, when, you know, to hear the evolutionary moment in your writing, to hear the recognition of levels of consciousness and the depth and subtlety with each, which you deploy it, really just adds so much to the evolutionary integral conversation.
Thank
and
you.
We're just unbelievably excited to have you there. So that's one. And the second part of the thank you is personal, and maybe three people on the phone will get it, but I think, Deepak, you will. I would say, as I was listening to you, I kind of thought that the great lineage of Abhinavagupta would have been so proud.
Thank you.
Thank you very, very, very much. And to everyone listening, thank you for your questions and for your time and for your presence. Right, please go on the Facebook page, share questions, share inquiries. We'll make sure to put up the reference to Love and Healing and that new website that Deepak spoke about. You know, give a new burst to that book, The Path to Love. Even though Deepak has 10 others, this is absolutely, you know, worth getting and worth reading. There's not a lot of books I recommend. It's a really, really good book. It kept me up till 4 in the morning, and it's utterly worthwhile. You know, we got maybe 50 questions that came with really incredibly complex and tragic life stories. To end with what Deepak said, you know, there's no way that you ever fall, right, when you don't fall into the hands of God. You can always get up. We can all get up. We all fall, and we get up, and just we should all rise up together like a phoenix from the fire. Brothers and sisters, let's fly higher together in deep depth and deep study as the integral evolutionary movement gathers. Thank you, Deepak. Have a beautiful day with Andrew and with Ken and with Marilyn. 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 Ken and with Marilyn.